Daniel chapter 8, verse 15. The eighth chapter of the book of Daniel is structured similarly to the seventh chapter, which we have looked at recently. We have, first of all, a visionary revelation, and then secondly, we have Daniel's curiosity about it, and then we have some explanation about it at the end of the chapter. But the way we've been covering these is to talk about the explanation when we look at the first part, so by the time we get halfway through the chapter, there's not too much left to do, and that's the case with chapter 8 tonight. I feel like we should read through it, but there's not too much additional information here for us. We talked about the 2300 days last time. Verse 15, so Daniel has just seen this vision. And it came to pass when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And we've had occasion to talk about what Daniel's experience must have been or might have been when he's seeing these things. He sees a personage that appears to be a man. I don't know whether there was any substance to this or not, but I rather doubt it. Probably if he had swept his hand through, he wouldn't have touched anything, and yet he is definitely seeing one who looks like an individual. I sort of look at this as if it was a holographic image. You may have been in an amusement park, and you're going through a little fun house of some sort, and when you get to the end, they try to sell you a picture of you and your wife, perhaps, in that roller coaster seat, but there's a ghost sitting in there with you. That's the kind of thing I feel like Daniel was having as an experience, just seeing something that was insubstantial and yet was actually there. It's just because there's no substance doesn't mean that this personage was not there. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and Ulai was one of the rivers in the Tigris-Euphrates system, as we have seen, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. Interestingly, the book of Daniel is the only Old Testament book where angels are named. In fact, there aren't very many books in the whole Bible where angels are actually named. Can you think of a New Testament book where angels are named? Oh, I don't think we need it for that. Go ahead and answer it, Chris.
Luke, we know the name of Michael.
In Luke, we have Gabriel, yes.
I thought it was Michael, sorry.
Where do we have Michael in the New Testament? Jude is right. So those are the two New Testament books where angels are named, both Jude and Luke. Very good, thank you. I just didn't think we needed a microphone for one-word answers, but thank you. I appreciate your alacrity. So both Gabriel and Michael are mentioned in the book of Daniel as well, but this doesn't happen very often. Gabriel is told to help Daniel to understand the vision. So, verse 17, he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face, but he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for the time of the end shall be, at the time of the end shall be the vision. So he's told that this will be at the time of the end. We have to make sure we understand the end of what. This is something that's pertaining to the last days, whatever introduces the last days, when the kingdom of God was going to be established. In other words, it's leading up to the last days of the Jewish system. And this is common biblical terminology. We have in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, where Paul in the first century says that we in the first century church are the ones upon whom the ends of the earth are come. In the Old Testament, we have Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established. That's talking about the establishment of the church, but it's in the last days. Last days of what? Last days of the previous system. In Hebrews 1 and 2, God hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son. So verse 17 is given in this kind of familiar biblical terminology. Gabriel is predicting the time of the end of the Jewish system, and this was hundreds of years future to the time Daniel is receiving this information. All right, let's read a little further here. As he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground, verse 18. But he touched me and set me upright, and he said, Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed, the end shall be. So once again, he's still talking about the end in verse 19. The end will be at the appointed time, specifically at the appointed time when the cup of iniquity is full. This is common biblical terminology as well. Back in the book of Genesis, we have the statement made to Abraham. And this was the time when the covenant with God was ratified between God and Abraham. Remember when he sliced the animals into pieces and then went back and forth between them, keeping the birds off. And there was a burning lamp that came representing God's ratification of the covenant with Abraham. And Abraham was told, I'm going to give you the land of Canaan and to your descendants, but not yet because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. It was going to be quite some substantial period of time before the children of Israel were going to have that land because God wanted to give full measure to these pagan people and they had the opportunity to repent. God knew with his foreknowledge that they would not. But their iniquity was not yet full. It's like there's a cup, and we have this symbolic representation in the Old Testament many times. There's a cup of iniquity, and the iniquity is going into it drop by drop as the grapes of wrath are squeezed out into this cup. And then when that cup is full, somebody has to drink it. That's the idea here. The end will be at the time that is appointed when the cup of iniquity is full. We can go a little further here in verse 20. And this is old information. We talked about this last week. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia, and the rough goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king, and we've seen that that was Alexander the Great, and we spent quite a lot of time talking about Alexander the Great. Now that being broken, that is Alexander being broken, we saw that he died as a young man at Babylon, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power, that is, not in the power of Alexander. None of these four, and we've talked about them before, Seleucus, Cassander, and Ptolemy, and Lysimachus, none of them would have the power that Alexander had had, but those are the four. And we referred ahead to these verses when we were looking to identify the symbols used in the earlier part of the chapter. So I think we can go on. Verse 23, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And we have identified this personage as Antiochus Epiphanes. He was the eighth of the Seleucid kings up in Syria. And we've seen quite dramatically last week, I think, how he just decimated the people of God. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also, he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand and he shall magnify himself in his heart and by peace shall destroy many. That is, rather than peace there, as we would commonly think of it, it's when they are in their security. In their security shall he destroy many. That's the idea. And he shall stand up against the prince of princes. The prince of princes, this is talking about the irreligion of Judaism in that time. And their cup of iniquity is getting fuller and fuller. In verse 25, the prince of princes is God. But he, that is Antiochus Epiphanes, shall be broken without hand. Broken without hand, meaning by divine agency. When we find something done without hand in the Bible, this is indicative of God doing that thing. Back in chapter 2, we saw in the series about the image there that the little stone was cut out of the mountainside without hand. That is, by divine agency. It was God who did it. Jesus said, I will build my church. And that was what was represented there. Here, Antiochus Epiphanes is going to be defeated without hand. In other words, it's not going to be any vindictiveness on the part of the Jews coming after him or anybody else in battle. And we probably ought to explain, this is the last thing we need to explain in this section about Antiochus Epiphanes being broken without hand. We've seen what he was doing to the people of Israel in Jerusalem and in Judea. And now he's returning from Persia. And he hears of the defeat of his armies in the Promised Land by the Maccabeans, and we talked last week about the Maccabean revolt. So hastening toward Canaan, Antiochus Epiphanes vows destruction for all Jews. However, en route, he was seized with severe internal pain. He suffered a violent fall from his chariot, which didn't help any, and he was forced to halt his journey. His body broke out with ulcers, the stench of which were intolerable. He became delirious. He may have had a condition known as phthisis, I think is the way we pronounce that, P-H-T-H-I-S-I-S. I think it's pronounced phthisis. Anyway, it's a progressive wasting away. It's a consumptive condition similar to pulmonary tuberculosis. Whatever his problem was, he finally rotted away and died a miserable death, not dissimilar, it seems, to what we have with Herod Agrippa in the 12th chapter of the book of Acts. He was eaten of worms and died a miserable death. This reminds me, the death of Antiochus Epiphanes reminds me of the death of Herod Agrippa. So, verse 26, the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. The vision shall be for many days. In other words, many days will elapse before this vision is accomplished. And we saw that it seems to have been accomplished conclusively in 164 AD, because that was the time of the death of Antiochus Epiphanes. Questions or comments on chapter 8? Ed, go ahead.
Yeah, there's several things. You know, the Greeks did a lot for spreading the knowledge of God unintentionally through the world. And so when the gospel message on the day of Pentecost was made, and they've been scattered through the empire, there were places to begin with.
Right.
And that's so important.
It was.
You know, if you was to evangelize a city today, where would you start?
Yeah.
You'd probably have to go door to door. But these people, the apostles and early disciples, had a place to go thanks to the Greeks. And I think the Greeks, the best thing they ever did, well, they gave us a common language too for that time, but they published the Septuagint to the world in 100 years before what we're talking about now.
Right.
And so when you hear people talking about the rise of Greece, it was before Greece was, even thought of.
Right.
And to me, that's so astounding. Yeah. It has to be divine. If you look at it, you know, the world was shocked when Trump got to be president, and that was, in just a short time. But so we don't know what world events are going to be. But yet, God did.
Right.
And he left it. And to me, these are building blocks of faith, at least in the Bible, that it came from a divine origin. So if it could do these things, and, you know, the truth of salvation in eternity is in them as well, because it says it is,
I agree completely. Thank you. Yes. The goal of Alexander, as we have seen, was to spread Greek culture throughout the world. That's why he wanted to conquer the world, not just to take over militarily, although he wanted that, but to spread Greek religion, Greek philosophy, Greek culture generally. And that's what Antiochus Epiphanes was trying to do too, like a little Alexander, like a little replica, a miniature Alexander. That's what Antiochus wanted to do, was spread this Greek culture. And the problem between him and the Jews, as we saw last time, was that he pushed too hard. If he had allowed it to continue to occur gradually, it would have been a much more insidious intrusion into the culture of the Jews. They had a strong home life, and they were preserving their language and their religion in the home. But still, it was making a lot of inroads until Antiochus Epiphanes came along and said, you got to become Greek in everything right now. Judaism is outlawed. And that's when they had the revolt, because they weren't going to put up with that. So Antiochus, if he had let up, would have probably accomplished more in spreading Greek culture. But yes, the Greek culture provided a matrix for the cradle of the church. Absolutely true. And that Koine language that the New Testament was written in was the best language it possibly ever in the history of the world could have been written in. And yes, that Septuagint, translated approximately 250 years before Christ, the Greek edition of the Old Testament, is the Bible that Jesus and the apostles commonly used when they're quoting and so forth. So it all goes back to the Greek Empire, which God predicted and providentially allowed to occur. Very good, Ed. Thank you. Other questions, comments, or thoughts? Okay, we come to chapter 9, and we can always go back if you want to comment on something else later. Chapter 9 is not structured the same as the previous two chapters. Here we have a lot of build-up for the first 23 verses, and then we have the prophecy in the final four verses of the chapter. This chapter contains what may be the most important messianic prophecy in the Old Testament. I say may because you could argue that others would be more important. I guess maybe I shouldn't even think in terms of which is the more important prophecy because they all go together. But this is among the most important and I think could be the most important. One time I asked a Jewish rabbi over in their temple over on the Kansas side. I said, sitting in his office, I said, what do you do with the ninth chapter of Daniel? And he said, oh, I'm sure we have an explanation for it. But he couldn't even find a copy of Daniel in his office. In his book-lined office, he couldn't find the book of Daniel in English or Hebrew. Just couldn't find it. So that conversation didn't go very far. But I think it's a question that every Jew who doesn't believe that Jesus was the Messiah should have to deal with. When Jesus came, people were expecting a Messiah. The Jews were expecting the Messiah to be a knight in shining armor to restore their sovereignty as a nation, but the pagans also were looking for the progeny of the gods, as their poets put it. Their poet Virgil, who died around 40 BC, their poet Horace, who died around 18 AD, these people and others said that the womb of the world is troubled as if the progeny of the gods would come to earth and cleanse it. So everybody, Jew and Greek alike, had this sense. It was kind of the zeitgeist of the time, the spirit of the age, that there's something about to happen. There's somebody about to come. And this chapter, of course, helped contribute to that expectancy. In the book of Matthew, we find that the wise men came from the east. That's from the very area where Daniel wrote this chapter. And undoubtedly, these wise men were familiar with these prophecies in their Zoroastrian religion. How else did they know it was his star? We have seen his star in the east. How did they know it was his star that they saw in the east? When they went to Herod in Jerusalem and they said, where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him. Interestingly, the Old Testament begins with God asking Adam in the garden, where are you? God is looking for man. But the New Testament begins with men asking, where is he? Man is looking for God. They were expecting a manifestation of deity to occur. Interestingly also, Matthew doesn't say that the wise men followed that star from the east. They said, we have seen it in the east. And they knew where to go look for the king of the Jews. You look for the king of the Jews in the land of the Jews. And after they talked with Herod, he sent them to Bethlehem based on another amazing prophecy in Micah chapter 5, verse 2. Thou Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands in Judah, you're going to be the place. So Daniel 9 tells the time. Micah tells the place, and all these arrows are honing in on the center of the bullseye, and they're all going to be fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Just as Daniel read Jeremiah's book, as we'll see in just a moment, and therefore knew what was supposed to happen next, so later on people read Daniel's book and knew what was supposed to happen next. With that little introduction, I think we're ready to get into the text. Daniel chapter 9, verse 1. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, and that's not the end of a sentence, but I'll stop right there just to mention when this was. The first year of Darius is 539/538 BC. It comes out of that two-year period, but it's a year in what we would call that two-year period of time. This is the same Darius we already saw in chapter 6 of the lion's den thing. Just a little point here that doesn't have much meaning for us, but the Ahasuerus mentioned here is Astyages, as found in historical references. Many of these people had multiple names, and that not ought to bother us unduly, but just a point in passing. The Jews now have been in captivity for about 67 years. Daniel is at least 80 years old by this time. We pick him up as a teenager in chapter 1. But he's probably in his 80s by now, probably a little ways into the 80s. And it's important to remember, I think, that this is the same Darius the Mede that we have met earlier. Verse 2, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. And I'll just give you a couple of places in Jeremiah where Jeremiah says this. First of all, Jeremiah 25, verses 11 and 12. This whole land, and Jeremiah was in the promised land prophesying from there, this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon for 70 years. It wasn't just the Jewish nation. Nebuchadnezzar took over other nations as well. These nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And it shall come to pass when 70 years are accomplished that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation for their iniquity and the land of the Chaldeans and will make it a perpetual desolation. Also in Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 10. For thus saith the Lord, that after 70 years be accomplished at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you in causing you to return to this place. And again, Jeremiah is writing from Jerusalem. So returning to this place means they're going to come back to the promised land. We ought to mention in passing, I think, here that Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel were all contemporaries with each other. If you think of this like a newscast, Jeremiah is the anchor man in Jerusalem, the city of God. Ezekiel is stationed with the exiles by the river of Kibar, as he says in his first chapter. He's down with the children of Israel in their captivity. And Daniel is stationed in the governmental capital with the kings. He's working with all the kings that go through from the Neo-Babylonian Empire and now in the Medo-Persian Empire during his lifetime. So he's kind of like Daniel, I think of as Talleyrand during the French Revolution. No matter who took over at any given time, Talleyrand was always right there, ready to be of service to whoever had the power at the time. And he survived one upheaval after another. Daniel is much the same way. Daniel says that from the writings of Jeremiah, he observed that the desolation of Jerusalem would be filled up within 70 years. And he realized that the 70 years had almost run their course. And yet, Daniel was not able presently to observe any sign that the promised restoration of Jerusalem was at hand. And this is the reason, I believe, that he goes to God in prayer. And he's very serious about this. Verse 3. I set my face unto the Lord God to seek by prayer and supplications with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. Notice the serious way that Daniel approaches God here. With fasting, mourning dress, ashes. There's nothing nonchalant about Daniel's approach to God. He's serious. He's wanting God to reveal to him new information. And he approaches this in as respectful, reverential manner as he possibly can with everything that he knows. Verse 4, I prayed unto the Lord my God and made my confession and said, O Lord, the great and dreadful God, keeping the covenant and mercy to them that love him and to them that keep his commandments, we have sinned. That expression in verse 5 says a lot. We have sinned and have committed iniquity and have done wickedly, and have rebelled, even by departing from thy precepts and from thy judgments. This is not dissimilar to what John read to us from the 64th chapter of Isaiah a while ago. This is often the approach of God's prophets. But it's an important thing. Not only the fasting, the mourning, dress, and the ashes, but the attitude that is revealed by all of this preparation. We have sinned. He includes himself, even though Daniel has been as faithful as anybody, more than most, maybe more than anybody else. We never read of a sin in Daniel's life. That doesn't mean he didn't have it. All have sinned except for the Lord and come short of the glory of God. So Daniel had sinned, and it's proper that he include himself in this, and yet he hadn't sinned nearly as much or nearly as egregiously as so many of the people that he includes with himself. Daniel is getting in tune with God here. He is confessing. And there was a lot to confess on the part of these people. He is representing the people. Verse 6, neither have we hearkened unto thy servants the prophets, which spake in thy name to our kings, our princes, and our fathers, and to all the people of the land. O Lord, righteousness belongeth unto thee, but unto us confusion of faces as it at this day, to the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and unto all Israel that are near and that are far off, through all the countries whither thou hast driven them, because of their trespass that they trespassed against thee. So your people are scattered, we're in captivity, we're in bondage, and we know it's our own fault. We wouldn't blame you about this. To us belongs confusion of faces, and the thing that he means by that, I believe, is shame. We're just ashamed of ourselves, as well we should be. And he says it again in verse 8, O Lord, to us belongeth confusion of face, to our kings, to our princes, to our fathers, because we have sinned against thee. To the Lord our God belong mercies and forgiveness, though we have rebelled against him. Neither have we obeyed the voice of the Lord our God to walk in his laws, which he set before us by his servants the prophets. Yea, all Israel have transgressed thy law, even by departing, that they might not obey thy voice. Therefore the curse is poured upon us, and the oath that is written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, because we have sinned against him. So he continues on in this same vein for quite some time here. He says in verse 12, he hath confirmed his words which he spake against us and against our judges that judged us by bringing upon us a great evil. For under the whole heaven hath not been done as hath been done unto Jerusalem. Jerusalem, of course, had been destroyed. In 586 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar had just leveled it to the ground, including the temple that Solomon had erected hundreds of years before. The terrible destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon was unequaled, it says here. And Jesus, of course, predicted that the next time would be worse, and it turned out to be worse in 70 A.D. He goes on here to say in verse 13, as it is written in the law of Moses, all this evil has come upon us, yet we made not our prayer before the Lord our God, that we might turn from our iniquities and understand thy truth. So it hasn't had the effect on us yet that it should. Therefore hath the Lord watched upon the evil and brought it upon us. For the Lord our God is righteous in all his works which he doeth, for we obeyed not his voice. And now, O Lord our God, that hast brought thy people out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand and hast gotten thee renowned, as at this day we have sinned, we have done wickedly. O Lord, according to all thy righteousness, I beseech thee, let thine anger and thy fury be turned away from thy city Jerusalem, thy holy mountain, because for our sins and for the iniquities of our fathers, Jerusalem and thy people are become a reproach to all that are about us. In saying this, verse 16, let your anger be turned away from your city Jerusalem. He reminds me of Moses when Moses interceded for the people. Remember, God was going to destroy the children of Israel. Moses said, oh, you don't want to do that. Your enemies will use this to criticize you, God. You don't want to destroy your people. And God said, well, I'll make you the leader of a new people. Moses said, no, you don't want to do that. And they had this conversation back and forth. I think probably God already knew what he was going to do, but that's a little test for Moses there. This seems similar to that. Let your anger be turned away from your city, Jerusalem, even though we deserve it, and even though we have done nothing that would cause you to forgive us, please forgive us anyway, and let us build our city back. That's the gist of the idea here. Verse 17, now therefore, O our God, hear the prayer of thy servant and his supplications, and cause thy face to shine upon thy sanctuary that is desolate for the Lord's sake. O my God, incline thine ear and hear. Open thine eyes and behold our desolations and the city which is called by thy name. That's Jerusalem, of course, flattened to the ground. For we do not present our supplications before thee for our righteousnesses, but for thy great mercies. This is very well put. The city that is called by your name. The idea here is, Heavenly Father, we're not presenting a case because we have done right. We're calling on you because we know you are a merciful God. That's our only stance here. We know you are merciful. You've proven it to us time and time again before. We're ashamed of our condition, but we're asking for you to fulfill the promise that you made about the 70 years. And Daniel wants fervently to know more about this. Verse 19, O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, hearken and do. Defer not. For thine own sake, O my God, for thy city and thy people are called by thy name. Forgive, hearken, do, defer not. That's the prayer. And do this for your own sake. You see how this reminds me of Moses' conversation many years earlier. God, for your own sake, for the credit to your own name, don't destroy your people. It's not that they don't deserve it, but for the credit to your own name, you've brought these people out of Egyptian bondage. You've brought them across the Red Sea. And if your enemies see you destroy them out here, then it's going to reflect badly on you. So the same thing here, for thine own sake, just like Moses, interceding for the people. Daniel is thinking of the good of God's name. So this prayer has its effect. Verse 20, whilst I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. This would be approximately 3 o'clock in the afternoon, broad daylight. Touched me around the time of the evening sacrifice. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. So while Daniel is praying, Gabriel appears. We just saw him mentioned in chapter 8, verse 16. Same angel. Gabriel appeared unto him approximately 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's interestingly put here in verse 23. At the beginning of thy supplication. Now, when was that? Well, that was back in verse 4. At the beginning of thy supplications, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore, understand the matter and consider the vision. Gabriel gets the command at verse 4. And he tells Daniel about it at verse 23. Angels are not omniscient. They can only be one place at a time. Now, they can morph. They can look different from one situation to the next. They have tremendous powers. But they're not omniscient any more than they're omnipotent. And they're not omnipresent. So he got this command wherever he was at verse 3, and verse 4, and he starts talking to Daniel at verse 23. I don't know. In the next chapter, we'll find something even stranger about angels, but we'll leave it to that. I don't understand it in either case, how these two worlds mesh. I just am not able to understand it. There is a definite dimensional shift from the human dimension to the divine dimension, and the angels can go back and forth between, it's just a shift that I can't fully grasp. So Gabriel may have been someplace way far off, and he comes maybe even quicker than the transatlantic Concorde, but yet it takes him time to do it because he's not like God. And that's about all I know about that. Daniel's interest was in Jerusalem, and that's what Gabriel is focusing on. Understand the matter and consider the vision. Daniel's interested in Jerusalem. It's his hometown. It's where he had been kidnapped from all those years ago when he was a boy. And now he's an old man. You ever noticed how sometimes when people get old, they go back to the place that they're from, no matter where they've been in the world, they've been all over making money or whatever they're doing, but they come back, they go back to the place that they're from, it seems, quite frequently. And I'm sure that Daniel probably would have liked very much to get back there. So his question is, and I'm going to put it on the screen here because I think it's important to impress upon us, what's going to happen to Jerusalem and to my people? That's what he's wanting to know about. We've got this prophecy that I read in Jeremiah, that 70 years is almost up, but what is going to happen? He knew that God had predicted very early in the Old Testament, I will choose a city from among you, and there will I write my name. And God has done that years ago. But Daniel knows that the Lord's house has been destroyed, and he's just wondering about the future. So I want to read these final four verses because they're all of one piece, and then we'll go back and talk about them. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood. And unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. There's a lot there. And this is so important that it takes a little time to unfold it, and we won't have time to unfold it all tonight. There are going to be 70 weeks, and these will be dated from the commandment, according to verse 25, to restore and to build the city of Jerusalem back again. There was going to be a command to do that, and that is the starting point of the 70 weeks. And it's critical to understand that that's where they start, because if they don't know where we start, we're not going to know where to end them. We know that the day-year concept applies here because 70 weeks is 490 days, and 490 literal days is less than 2 years. And this prophecy was not fulfilled 2 years from any one of the decrees. There's four decrees we'll have to look at to determine which is the right one. But this prophecy was in no way fulfilled within 2 literal years from any of these decrees that the time could be counted from. So this prophecy, as much as any other that we have, I think, proves the day-year theory to be more than a theory. It's just a biblical concept. I will give thee a day for a year. I have given you a day for a year. Numbers 14:34, Ezekiel 4, verse 6. We've talked about that before. Within 490 years of that event, the decree we're going to be looking for, a new kingdom was going to be inaugurated that was never going to be destroyed. Chapter 2, verse 44. Then people would no longer need to look for the restitution of an earthly Jerusalem. Now, that's what Daniel was looking for. But after this kingdom was established, you no longer need to look for the restitution of an earthly Jerusalem. So that's how this fits with the question that Daniel is asking. God is going to tell Daniel the answer to his question, but he's going to tell him more than he asked for. And a great deal that helps us in our own time. A tremendous prediction. Within 490 years of that decree, a new kingdom would be established. That's the idea here. The prediction was that in 7 weeks, that's 49 years, 7 times 7 being 49 days, meaning 49 years, in 49 years the city of Jerusalem would be rebuilt. And then within the next 62 weeks, that's 434 more years, the Messiah would be anointed. A total of 483 years, that's the 69 weeks. That would bring us to the appearance of the Anointed One, the Messiah. And then by the completion of the 70 weeks, the 490 years, we would see the confirmation of the covenant with many. But what's the starting point? There were four decrees. We need to find out which one of these decrees fits the criteria of verse 25 and when to date that decree. So we need to briefly just look at these four decrees, because there has been a lot of controversy about which one of these decrees is the decree that's intended here. I could tell you what I think, but I want you to see these decrees for yourself, and you can decide for yourself. The first one of these, and we're going to have to quit at an awkward place, but clear back in Ezra chapter 1 is the first one of these decrees, and it has to do with King Cyrus in 536 B.C. Ezra 1 verse 2. Thus saith Cyrus the king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him an house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? His God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel. He is the God which is in Jerusalem. And whoever remaineth in any place where he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver, with gold, with goods, and with beasts, beside the freewill offering for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. All right, this is a commission to rebuild the temple. It has nothing to do with rebuilding the city of Jerusalem. It has nothing to do with rebuilding the wall. The prediction in verse 25 of Daniel 9 talks about rebuilding the city and the wall. You'll remember that they started rebuilding the temple with tremendous enthusiasm when they got back. Cyrus sent people back there, 42,360. They came back to rebuild the temple with tremendous enthusiasm, but they got discouraged pretty soon. It wasn't long before there was sagebrush growing up around the foundation of the temple, which they had laid. And it took two prophets by the name of Haggai and Zechariah in 520 B.C., to spur the work of the temple building forward again. And because of this spurring, then the second temple was completed in 516 B.C. And one way that it's possible to date the 70 years of the Babylonian captivity is from 586 B.C. when the temple was destroyed by Nebuzaradan, the captain of the host of Nebuchadnezzar, down to 516 when the next temple was completely rebuilt. That's an exact 70-year period of time. That's not the only way to date the 70 years, but it's one way to date the 70 years. Quite often there's more than one way, sometimes as many as three ways to do these datings. But the second temple was completed in 516 B.C., so that's the first decree, but it's not a decree to restore and to build Jerusalem. So I believe we can eliminate it from our consideration. And I'm sorry, but I want you to come back next week. So I have to stop right now to perhaps facilitate that process. Thank you very much. And I'm enjoying this class with you. Bill, we're ready for some announcements.